That song that we just sang is much of what I'm going to talk about today in many respects. So, you know, we could just go and sit down and be done. But then I wouldn't use all the stuff here that I have here. So we'll go with it. So the stories from Hebrews 11 that we have been looking at the last few weeks are ones that are very familiar stories to us. In fact, probably some of the best known stories out of the Old Testament. You know, stories like, well, we didn't look at all of them, but people like Abraham and Moses and Noah and those kind of people, these are stories that we know well and have often heard from the age of those kids who just went upstairs. I mean, they're stories that we know well, but there's always something else in them for us, and so hopefully we can find something here today. But it makes sense, you know, that those stories are going to be well. Stories of people who are renowned for their faith in the circle of faith. Those are going to be people who we're going to be wanting to know about, right? The same as, you know, somebody who's renowned for their hockey abilities, for instance, is well known in the circles of hockey, you know, and so maybe Winnipeg Jets are going to give us a chance to get a cup here in Canada again, I don't know. But, you know, like, of course it makes sense that these are people who we're going to know about and think about here, but there is much to learn from not just their story, but what happens in their story. And so we're going to look at another one of these, and that's the story of Gideon. And when you look in Hebrews 11, when it talks about Gideon, all it has is his name. There's no story there at all. It just has a list of, I mean, it talks about Abraham and Moses and Noah and all these people. And then it just says, and what about these people? And there's just his name in a list. So there's only one word. So we're not going to get a lot out of Hebrews 11, but we're going to go back to Judges. So turn to Judges chapter 6, and that's where the story the beginning of the story of Gideon. And it's three chapters. I'm not going to read it all, and you do know it well, but I'll kind of recount some of it to you just to remind you what happens in the story of Gideon, and then we'll look at a few things afterwards. So we find in the beginning of chapter 6 of Gideon's that the Midianites, which was a neighboring country to the Israelites, they were people that were nomadic. Okay, in other words, they went around from place to place and got what they could get from those people and then moved on to somewhere else. And so as it happens, and we read this here, that every year for 7 years they would come in right at harvest time and take all that they could and walk all over the rest and be on their way. And so it wasn't going so well for the Israelite people. In fact, there wasn't much food because all the work that they had put into, they were losing all this, and this was happening year after year after year. And the fact that it took them 7 years to cry out to God is a statement in and of itself. You know how sometimes it takes something really major before we look to God, and even a lesson for us now that we don't have to wait 7 years before we look to God. We need to learn to look to God right at the outset, right? Anyways, they cry out to God, and the Lord hears their cry, and he comes to Gideon. And so this is the beginning of that story. And so the Lord tells Gideon that he is the one who is going to lead the Israelites out of this Midianite oppression that they have been under. And he shows them that he is, in fact, the Lord. I mean, it says an angel of the Lord, but that's who is talking to him, because he holds his staff out, and the sacrifice that had there just goes up in flames just when he touches it with the tip of the staff, which isn't the sort of thing that the rest of us can do, okay? And so he sees, even just in that, that this is God speaking to him. And so he gives him a little job just to kind of begin to get people to pay attention to him and to listen to what he has to do. And so Gideon goes and he tears down an idol in that area, and all of a sudden people start to pay attention to Gideon. Here's somebody who might be a leader who can help us in the midst of what we're in. And so then Gideon goes to God and he asks for some assurance. And this is probably the most familiar, or one of the most familiar of the stories of Gideon's life, that of the fleece, right? You remember that story where Gideon asks God, first of all, to have the fleece. He puts a fleece out on the ground at night, and he says, I want you to make the fleece all wet and the ground all dry. So he wakes up the next morning, and of course the fleece is all wet and the ground's all dry, which is kind of cool, you know. But then He says, okay, well, let's just do it again and we'll switch it around. Okay, this time, make the fleece dry and the ground wet. And sure enough, it happens. And so finally, Gideon is convinced enough that, okay, I guess this is God. I can go ahead with what he's asked me to do. And so he proceeds. And so they have, the Israel army has 32,000 men, okay, which in those days is pretty reasonable. But the Midianite army in their camp have 135,000, and as nomads, they're always prepared for battle, right? And so the odds aren't looking very good in his favor, you know, kind of 4-1 against them. But then God comes to Gideon, asks him to pare down his army, because he says, you have too many. And off the top, we think, what are you talking about? I don't have nearly enough. But obviously, God wants Gideon to see that God is the one who's going to win this battle. It's not Gideon, and it's not his army. It's God who's going to do it. So Gideon goes to the people and says, anybody who's scared, feel free to go home. Okay? 22,000 people go home. So obviously, they're not liking the odds here either. Okay, so now we're down to 10,000 men. And there's 135,000, so 13.5 for everyone, okay? The odds are getting worse. Now, if they win the battle, obviously, this had to be God who did it. But God says, that's not good enough. We need to go a step further, okay? And then we have the story where they go down to the river, and he watches them how they drink out of the, how they have a drink. That would have taken a long time to watch 10,000 people drinking out of the river. But anyways, he ends up with only 300 men, okay? And so now, for every one of the Israelites, there's 450 Midianites. So if they're going to win this battle, obviously, it's not in their own strength. It has to be in God's victory. And so as we know, each of the 300 has a trumpet and a torch inside a clay jar. And at the time, at the signal, they go out and they blow their trumpets and they smash their jars and hold it up. And this is in the middle of the night that this is happening. And the Midianites, they woke up and they must have thought there were hordes of people coming down, because normally you only would have a trumpet and a torch, you know, one for every big group of soldiers. So they see all these coming down the hills towards them, and they just get up and they pull their sword out and they just start swinging at it, because they got to get all of these enemies that are all over the place. And they kill 120,000 of their own people without any of Gideon's men being harmed in that. And so obviously, it was God who won the battle. This wasn't something that they did on their own. This was something that God made happen, and he confused the Midianites to go and do that and to kill each other. And there's a little more to the story, but that's basically it, right? And it's a story, like I said, that we remember well. So there are three chapters in just a couple of minutes. And Gideon leads the people for 40 years after this, and one other story we'll look at a little bit later from his life as well. The one thing that Gideon is most known for, though, and this is what I want to think about here this morning, is kind of like Thomas in the New Testament. Thomas is known for one thing. What do we call Thomas? Doubting Thomas, right? Well, here, Gideon is known for being a doubting Gideon. Okay, he was someone who didn't really know, is God going to be there for me? Can I really trust him, what he has to say? And this kind of thing. And so this is what he's mostly known for. The fact that he didn't really believe. He said, well, let's do another test, and let's do another test, and let's do another. He kept doing this with God before he finally went ahead. But when we look at him in Hebrews 11, and he's called a man of faith, obviously the essence of his being wasn't just one of unbelief, but really, it must have been one of belief. He was a man of faith. But we see that unbelief was a part of that. And so that's what I want to think about this morning, because in all of our lives, you know, I mean, we put our faith in God, but sometimes there's a little bit of that unbelief in there as well. And you know, I'm not saying it in the sense of I don't believe in God kind of unbelief, but really, you know, in the sense of the man who came to Jesus once in Mark 9:24, and he said, I do believe, but help me overcome my unbelief. And that's kind of where I think we're all at to some extent. You know, we believe in God. We know who he is. We know the things that Jesus has done for us and the difference that has made. But yet sometimes we don't or can't take that step that really shows, yeah, I really believe this, which is evidenced by the things that we do in our life. So what can we do? So what I'd like to, from looking at Gideon's story here, what I'd like to propose this morning is that we too will have doubts and unbelief in our lives without an ever-present awareness of God in our lives. And the more that becomes a reality to us, the more God's presence, we sense it more and more, the less and less we will have this thing as part of our life, and the more we'll stand on the things that we have come to believe. Judges chapter 6 and verse 13, one of the verses that I want to look at is, as we begin here. So this is in the midst of this story, and we read here. But sir, this is Gideon talking to the angel of the Lord who came to him. But sir, Gideon replied, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our father told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hands of Midian. And I was thinking about that phrase there, the Lord has abandoned us. Here we see he is really feeling desperately, where's God? You know, and it's the kind of thing that we hear nowadays, right? We hear people asking that question, you know, where was God when that semi T-bone, that bus full of hockey players and of the Humboldt hockey team, right? Or where was God when Alec, whatever his name was driving down Yonge Street in Toronto on the sidewalk? Where was God when these things were happening? And people ask this kind of question, you know, the same as Gideon did right here. They feel like God has abandoned them. Sometimes we feel that way. And we think, well, where's God? How come he's not changing all these things the way that we think he should? How come he's not doing that? We have that kind of question sometimes. And so we need to be able to address that. And we know, first of all, you know, before we get in, I mean, I've got a few points on your outline there, but before we get into that, we know as Christians that it can never be the case that God is going to abandon us, even though sometimes we feel that way. We just need to be reminded of truths, you know, like, well, Deuteronomy 31:6 and Hebrews 13:5 that both say, I will never leave you. I mean, we know that, right? We know that truth. And so we know that he won't. But just sometimes we feel like that's the case. And so that's what we need to address a little bit. I mean, a favorite poem of many Christians is the one that we often call Footprints, right? And you probably all heard that at some point, but if you haven't, it describes a man's life kind of by two sets of footprints in the sand, right? And so as the poem goes on, the man who's speaking or whatever says that in many of life's hardest times, he noticed there's only one set of footprints. And so he says to God, well, why was this the case? How come there you left me at those times? And of course, as you know, the Lord replies to him, it was then that I carried you. Right? God doesn't abandon us. Even though sometimes we might feel like that has happened, it's because we're too much seeing the things right around us and we aren't being aware of God's presence there. I came across a quote by a man named George MacDonald, and I don't know if you know him. He was an author 150 years ago or something, but probably the greatest influence on C.S. Lewis. So there's somebody, you know, you've heard of C.S. Lewis. MacDonald's most famous book was called At the Back of the North Wind. But anyway, you can go find some of his and read it, and you'll enjoy it. Good author. But anyways, here's a quote of his, and here's what he says. Talking about God. He says, he will carry us in his arms till we are able to walk. He will carry us when we are weary with walking. But he will not carry us if we will not walk. Okay, let me say that again to you. He will carry us in his arms till we are able to walk. He will carry us when we are weary with walking. But he will not carry us if we will not walk. So if we want to become more aware of God's presence in our life, if we don't want to feel like God is abandoning us, he's saying, you need to do something. And that's just like the song that we just sang. We need to trust and obey. We have to put faith in him, but then we need to do something. We need to obey, and we need to respond to that. Of course, being aware of God's presence, first of all, has to start with him coming into our life. We're not going to be aware of his presence if we haven't asked Jesus into our heart. And so that's where it has to start. But then sometimes we lose the sense of that awareness, and so we need to do something about it. So there's four things that I discovered or thought of, you know, looking at Gideon's life that we can do to develop our relationship with God, to deepen the awareness that we have of his presence. And hopefully we can learn from Gideon in that. So the first one of them is humility. Despite the fact that initially in Gideon's response we see a lack of faith, we can also see great humility. Just a couple of verses after where I just read to you, so in verse 15 of Judges 6, it says, "But Lord," Gideon asked, "how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." Here is a man who was not proud of himself, right? But we see that he dared to take on the world later on. But at this point, he was far from that. Described himself as the very lowest person in all of Israel, which isn't somebody who's really showing a lot of pride. Now, this doesn't mean that we need to be self-deprecating, you know, and saying, oh, you're this terrible loser kind of thing. That isn't what God calls us. But we need to have a right image of who we are in God's eyes. We need to recognize that next to God, we're not much. But in God's eyes, God values us greatly and has much for us to do. And we see the same thing in Paul speaking in 1 Timothy about himself, and he says, I'm the worst of all sinners, right? But when we think about Paul's story, we know Paul was not the worst of sinners, but he's looking at himself next to God and seeing the difference there is there. I've often shared about when you leave Calgary and you drive off towards Banff, and you see the mountains in the distance, right? And they look majestic, right? They look good. And you get closer, though, and they look bigger. And if you get to the point where you're climbing up the side of them, and they look really big, right? Yeah. But you know what? They're exactly the same mountains when you were in Calgary than when you're climbing up the side. And it's the same with God, is that he's the same God if we look at him far away or as we get to know him better. But as we get to know him better, we feel that presence all the more, right? And so we need to desire to get to know God better. But even if we were the worst, I was thinking of another verse which I didn't write down here, 1 Corinthians 1 and 27. It reminds us that God can use us. 1 Corinthians 1 and 27. It reads there, "But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are." I mean, it's not really an ego booster to read that and think that God has chosen you. But it's to help us to see that God is the one that's doing the work. It isn't something that we do, something that God does. But he calls us, as we see with Gideon, to be willing and to stand up and to obey. And when we do that, God will use that. And so in humility, we can become ever more aware of God's presence. And so have ever less the kind of doubts and that kind of thing that often can happen. And when I think of, you know, humble people with a keen awareness of God and no lack of faith, you know, with lots of faith, I mean, a number of different single missionary ladies, you know, came to my mind as I was thinking about that yesterday. You know, somebody who is humble and yet knows God well because they look to him in faith. And so we need to see that's the first thing that we need to do if we want to have less times when we're having doubts and that kind of thing. We need to be humble and remember who we are and remember who God is and the difference that he can make in our lives. Okay, the second one on your outline there. I was reading a book the other day called the practice of the presence of God. And it might be one that many of you are familiar with by a monk named Brother Lawrence, who lived 300 or 400 years ago in France. And in it he talks, according to the title, of how he practices the presence of God, and how he senses God in his life all the time. He senses that God is there. And here's what he says. This is just a quote from the book. He says, "Live as if God and you were the only ones in the world. Live as if God and you were the only ones in the world." Now, if you think about that for a moment, if that was the case, you know, if we were the only ones, of course you're going to have a relationship with God, and it's going to deepen if there's just two people, if you're the only ones. And he says, live if that's the case, that you're the only one in the world. Now, we might say, well, that's kind of unrealistic, because that's not true, of course, right? We're not the only two. There are lots of other people in the world, and there's so much happening around us, and there's so many people, and how can I possibly, you know, live that kind of thing? But then Jesus gives us the answer for that in Matthew 25. And he says at verse 37, and this is in the middle of the story of the sheep and the goats, and he says, "Then the righteous will answer him, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?' And the king will reply, 'I tell you the truth. Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me.'" And that's how we can know that there's only God and us in the world, is that we see him in everyone around us. So if all we do is out of love for God, I'm letting God's love flow through us, then we'll become more aware of his presence in our life. And again, less prone to unbelief. When you look in the story of Gideon, in chapter 6 and 7 of Judges, five times at least we see that there's just Gideon and God together. And as a result of that, he became ever more aware that God was the only thing that mattered. And so what he did for God. And so we need to see the same as he did, so that he could go to the point of taking 300 men against an army of 135,000 and not worry about it. He had to be aware of God's presence and that God was there. Now the next point that I have kind of flows out of that. For as we're living as if God and us, God and you, are the only two people in the world, we're going to spend a lot of time in communion with him, in connection with him, and talking to him and listening to him. In Brother Lawrence's book, he says we should be continually conversing with him, is how he talks about it. And that comes from here. You know, 1 Thessalonians 5:17 says, pray continually, right? Or Ephesians 6 says, pray in the Spirit on all occasions. So we need to be continually in a state of prayer. And in Brother Lawrence's book, he says, you know, to get to the point where he could continually do that, he says, it took 10 years with some diligence to get to that point. So this isn't something that happens just like that, but it takes a little bit of work to get to the point where we're always coming before God first, when prayer is our first recourse instead of our last. It's so easy for us to do all of the things that we are able to do as people, right? And then, oh, none of that's working. Okay, well, I guess it's time to pray. And that's what happens so often, right? And so easily, but we need to see that that is not the best. I was remembering a time some years ago when we were doing some drywall. I don't think I ever shared this, but anyways, we were putting some drywall up, and as is the case when you often do that, you lean the drywall against the wall, right? So there was about 40 sheets of drywall, and behind it there was a sheet of plywood that I wanted to get out. I don't remember why. So anyways, took the drywall and just tipped it up a bit to get the sheet of plywood out, but tipped it enough that it kept coming, okay? And so there was a wall right behind me, and this drywall came, and it went right across my chest and pinned me against the wall. So I got 40 sheets of drywall, which they weigh about 60 pounds each. You know, so there's 2,400 pounds. And so I tried with all my might to push this away, but Samson, I was not. And so it didn't move. And I thought, well, what else can I do? Because my arms were trapped too, and I couldn't get them out, you know. And so I tried to get my arms out, and I couldn't get my arms out. And It actually was getting hard to breathe because my lungs were getting squashed. And I tried yelling, like it was an addition on our house, and so the people were in the house, and I yelled as loud as I could with limited breath. And they didn't hear me. What am I going to do? And so I prayed. And it was less than a minute later that my dad was there, pulling up. Well, I actually tried to pull all the sheets at once, but I said, one at a time. And I got out. But you know what? I had to try all these things first before I prayed. And that's not the way we're supposed to do it. I have mentioned before, and I just found it the other day, a quote of Martin Luther's that he said many years ago. And here's what he says along those lines. He says, if I fail to spend 2 hours in prayer each morning, well, he said this in German, so it was different than this, but if I fail to spend 2 hours in prayer each morning, the devil gets the victory through the day. I have so much business, I cannot get on without spending 3 hours daily in prayer. That's kind of intriguing, right? Because we think, I have so much to do, I don't have time to stop and do this. But he said, if I don't take 2 hours to do this, I don't have enough time. If I take those 2 hours, I have lots of time, and everything will go well. So we need to see where our power comes from. Not from us, but from within, from the Spirit within us. Okay, fourthly, the last thing we need to do, I mean, the last thing of the four things that I'm giving to you here this morning, certainly there's many more than that, is we need to keep the bigger picture in mind. So often in our Christian walk, as we move along, we're walking and we're looking at our feet, right? Which is the way we tend to sometimes even in life walk along, you know, and you're walking where you're going and seeing what's there because you don't want to stumble over it. But the chapter after Hebrews 11, in Hebrews 12, it starts and it says, keep your eyes on Jesus. We need to keep our eyes on where we're going instead of looking and spending all our time looking at our feet. We need to keep the bigger picture in mind, and that will help us in that as well. If we're looking towards eternity with him, we'll be very much aware of his presence in our lives. 2 Corinthians 4, again, verses that are familiar to us, it says, therefore we do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, what is unseen is eternal. If that's what we have in our mind's eye, if we have our eyes fixed on Jesus, we see the big picture, and the doubts and such that sometimes will creep into our life, they'll just be pushed away because of that. As I was thinking of that verse yesterday, I was thinking of one in 2 Kings. You know, there's the same kind of story, but it's a very obvious one. This is the life of during the life of Elisha, and he's with his servant, and they're surrounded by the enemies. And kind of Elisha's servant is kind of thinking, so what's going to happen? What, you know, we don't have any hope here, right? And so Elisha says, well, let's read. So the 2 Kings 6, and let me read it, verse 15. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh, my Lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes so he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Now, it doesn't mean that we're going to see this kind of stuff, but we can be assured that God is there. And the chariots of fire are there, right? And they're around us. And we can rest in that. That's what he's saying. I'm resting in the joy of who you are. We need to see that and understand that we need to keep the big picture in mind. Back in Judges again, Judges chapter 8, we see that Gideon did this. Judges 8, and reading at verse 7, it says there, again, this is breaking into the middle of the story. Well, we'll just read the right before. Somebody says, "Why should we give bread to your troops?" Then Gideon replied, "Just for that, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will tear your flesh with desert thorns and briars." Not so much what he's intending to do, but what I cut out of that was where he says, when the Lord gives it into our hands, this is going to happen. God said it's going to happen, so it's going to happen. So he had that big picture in mind. He knew who God was and what God can do, and so he wasn't worried. And we see him saying the same thing again a couple of verses later. He knew that God was going to provide the victory, and so he wasn't worried at all as to how that was going to happen at all. So when all the world seems to be crumbling at your feet, keep your eyes fixed on Jesus, and that will help take away those doubts that say, where is God in the midst of this? I was thinking about Chuck Colson, and those of you who are older in the room will remember him. He was one of Nixon's top affiliates, right, in the days of Watergate, and ended up in prison as a result of his involvement in it, but became a Christian between the time of the fiasco and his conviction. And he said, God is in control in the midst of this. And he ended up in prison, but as a result of that, untold hundreds and thousands of people have come to the Lord through Chuck Colson's prison ministries. So God has the bigger picture in mind, and we need to keep the bigger picture in mind. And then when things are happening, we can trust that God is aware of what he's doing. Now, one other thing I wanted to mention, you know, before we leave Gideon behind, a brief comment on the end of his life, because in towards the end of Judges chapter 8, we have a story where essentially Gideon kind of leads the nation into idolatry, and doing very much the opposite of what he had been before. And what that reminds us of, you know, as I was thinking about that, is that even though he's one of the heroes of the faith, according to Hebrews 11 and from these stories in the Old Testament, he was still human, and he could still slip up. And you can be sure that at that point in Judges 8, when that happened, he had not kept his eyes on the Lord, and he'd looked away, and so something else, the devil was quick to throw something else in there to make us fall. And so we need to keep practicing the presence of the Lord. It isn't something that you can do, and I got this good, and you're good for the rest of your life. No, we need to keep doing that. We need to keep looking to God, because otherwise, as we see at the end of Gideon's life, we can fall too. So we need to recognize and remember that we are human as well. So as we become more aware, though, of God's presence through increased humility in our lives, by living as if God and I are the only ones, and so treating all others as if they were him, through increased communion with him and in prayer particularly, and by keeping our eyes on him despite what happens, as we do these things, then we'll find that our doubts and our unbeliefs will begin to be less and less common in our lives. We can have victory over doubt, as we see Gideon did. Keep your eyes on Jesus. Let me pray. Father, we do thank you again for these stories of these faithful men of yours and women, these different stories, people who stood up for you despite all of the things that came against them. They were faithful. Even when doubts and unbelief were there, help us, Father, to be people who are humble and remembering who you are and coming to you in prayer and keeping our eyes fixed on you, that will help bring us through those times. Just thank you again for all you do, for being with us here this morning. Just help us to take you with us as we leave, we pray in Christ's name. Amen.